called Noble Truths in Buddhism. Usually come in the form of talking about suffering and the end of suffering. The first truth is called Noble Truth of Suffering. Second one is called the Noble Truth of the Origin of the Source of Suffering. Third one is the Noble Truth of Cessation of Suffering. And the fourth is the path or the way leading to the cessation or the end of suffering. But it is also possible to look at this whole topic or these four items from the point of view of happiness, the opposite of suffering. And I think sometimes it's good to look at it that way because we human beings, we are naturally drawn to happiness. And we probably pay more attention to happiness than to suffering. After all, we do tend to avoid the topic of suffering. We don't like to think about it. We don't like to experience it. We don't like to have anything to do with suffering. So given a choice, we'd rather not have anything to do with suffering, right? So we definitely probably wouldn't want to attend a course about suffering. No, life is suffering enough. I don't need you to teach me about suffering. So instead of belaboring on suffering, we can talk about happiness, yeah, and look at the same topic from a different perspective. And I think that can also be quite helpful. And so I decided to this word happiness, we can look at it from in terms of what I call conditional happiness and unconditional happiness. So the goal of Buddhism, you can actually say it is aiming forward towards the unconditional happiness, or I rather call it unconditional peace. Yeah, and we'll look at what could that be. But let's start with conditional happiness. Right. So the word conditional here means happiness that depends on conditions. Right. And there's good news and bad news altogether. Good news is because it's dependent on conditions. So if we get the right conditions, then we'll be happy, right? So we just need to get all those right conditions together. The bad news is, of course, since it's dependent on conditions, so when the conditions change or dissipate or disappear, then there goes your happiness because it's dependent on those conditions. And conditions by nature, they change. Yeah. Okay, but let's look a little bit at what could be different types of conditional happiness. And one way to look at it is look at under the first Noble Truth of Suffering, the Buddha listed eight items. Eight items, these are quite famous: birth, aging, sickness, death, encounter with the unpleasant, separation from the pleasant, and not having one's wishes fulfilled, right? So that's seven of them. The eighth is a bit tricky, so we will come back to it later. So if we reverse this eight, then we might get an idea of conditional happiness. Right? So birth is just stay as birth. But yesterday, I just celebrated good news that one of my friends, she recently discovered she was pregnant. She is pregnant with twins, yeah. So we celebrate, hey, how nice, you know. So birth is often associated in our society with happiness, right? Although not so long ago, that's not always true, right? Because in the pre-contraceptive days, you know, like for example, my mother's generation, my mother came from a peasant family in China. And she was one of many, many, I don't know how many kids there are, no, she never mentioned it to me, but so many that her parents couldn't feed her. So they gave her away. You know, she was sort of adopted by some other family. I couldn't understand what is the rationale behind it. But clearly, in the old days, not so long ago, actually, birth is not always a pleasant thing. So birth could bring along suffering, which is why the Buddha lists birth as one item of suffering, yeah. But these days, when we talk about birth, we tend to associate with happiness, isn't it? Until they know what is involved, yeah. as those parents told me, I don't know, I'm not parents, yeah. but it's getting more and more expensive raising children. Then the next item, of course, Buddha said aging. So the reverse of it, of course, is youth, right? Or anti-aging these days, yeah. So the idea of not having to age to stay youthful, right? This I realized I have to be very careful. Sometimes people don't like this word. Like for example, say they are 60 years old. That is unacceptable. It has to be 60 years young. And then there will be 70 years young, and then 80 years young. Then you wonder, are they trying to banish this word old from the vocabulary? Which is fine, I mean, it's just a word. But then if you use young from 0 up to 90 years old, then it doesn't mean that you never age, right, isn't it? But still, we like the idea of staying young. Yeah. Or if we can't stay young, at least we try to look young. Right, so that is it's associated with youth, for youthfulness, it's associated with happiness, right? Which is why I think it's a billion-dollar industry. Yeah, to look young, stay young, be young, and so on, or feel young. Yeah. So youth is associated with happiness also. Right? I think you sort of know where I'm getting to. The next one is sickness. What's the opposite of sickness or illness? It's health, right? And no one will begrudge themselves for being healthy, isn't it? Now, health is quite often associated with physical well-being, also mental well-being, with the ability to enjoy, you know, the wonderful things in life, which will be deprived of it when we are sick or we are ill and suffering from all the different aches and pains. So health is quite often also associated with happiness, right? And of course, the fourth item would be death. So what the opposite of death is life, right? Life itself, life. So life is something also conditional, and we hang on to it, you know, for dear life. So we all want to stay alive. In fact, the ideal, which is not something new, is to live forever. It's an immortality, right? People even freeze their brain if they don't have that much money, or they freeze their entire body if they have a lot of money for posterity, until one day someone, I don't know why they will bother to revive you, even though you are frozen solid, yeah. But we try all sorts of ways to put off death, you know? We try all sorts of ways to achieve immortality. That's how strongly we hold on to life, and how strongly life is associated with our notion of happiness. Yeah. Someone just told me that I think last week I had a conversation with a friend, and says, talking about Bill Gates, that how Bill Gates managed to finish some ridiculous, like 30 books in 1 week, or some ridiculous amount of information. And they're saying that it's because he felt that time is running out. And there's so much more new information he wanted to gather. No, I suppose he's not young, and his clock is ticking, and that now, clearly has not short of money. So what he's running short of is time. Right? So that is one way of trying to get as much out of life as possible. Especially since you don't have to work. Yeah. Right. So that's life. Okay, so this is the first: birth, youthfulness, health, and life. These are the first four items that we commonly associate with happiness. Right. And then the next three items, the Buddha talked about the suffering of encounter with the unpleasant. Encounter with anything that will trigger unpleasant feelings, unpleasant experiences within ourselves. So the reverse, of course, is what we are very good at doing, is to not encounter anything unpleasant, isn't it? We do our best to avoid or to put away, out of sight, out of mind, anything that would trigger unpleasant sensations or unpleasant feelings within us, right? Hence, climate control of a limited, I really appreciate the aircon since I moved back to Singapore. I would have died without the aircon. I really find it very unbearable, the heat and the humidity. So we would do all these things in order to avoid experiencing, for example, in my case, the unpleasantness of heat. I think I told this funny story. I went to a retreat in Malaysia. Malaysia, similar climate as us, right? Maybe the haze is worse than us. There's about more than 100 of us. It's a silent retreat in a temple, a Chinese temple. And you know, on retreat, you can't talk, right? Silent. So there's very limited avenue to complain. So we all strive to control our lives, control the environment to get it ideal. So what do they control? They control the aircon. Some people say it's too cold. And I say it's too hot. Some say too drafty. Some say it's not enough, not strong enough. Until the aircon went busted. So they managed to get it fixed, and then the organizer said, I'm confiscating the remote control. So it's set at this particular temperature, at this particular fan speed, and you just adjust yourself. You move yourself around the hall, put on blanket, take off blanket, do whatever you want, but no one will touch the aircon. So that is a little thing that happened in our silent retreat that typified how hard we try, you know, each one of us to avoid anything that would trigger unpleasant experiences in us, right? So some people feel it's too cold, we don't like it, so that's why we try to get it warmer. Others feel it's too hot, so we try to get it cooler. Some don't like the feeling of the draft, you know, touching your neck or shoulder, so you try to turn down the fan speed or switch it off, and others really like the feeling of a cool breeze. So human beings, like a real whole 100 of people in silence, and there's nothing to distract the mind. You know, so this is quite natural for us to try our best to control those, avoid experiencing unpleasantness. So I actually organized quite a few of these meditation retreats. And one of the things that I learned very early on is on, especially on a silent retreat, you really must make great effort to get the food up to standard. Otherwise, you will never hear the end of the complaint, right? The food, it's like, it's a source of, it's like a magnet attracting their attention. Because the rest of the time, they have to watch their breath. The only relief for the breath is during mealtime. And so people are very hypersensitive about their food. Some people even say, I don't have enough protein intake from this meal. I thought, you're not going to die from it, for this one meal, to not have enough protein. But anyway, but we do, especially like for example in this case, with food, we really try very, very hard in order to not experience any unpleasantness, but to, and this is true even if, this is very common in Singapore actually, when I was working in aged care sector. People who suffer from diabetes, very serious diabetes, yeah. And one of the things to help control the progression of the disease is actually change of diet, isn't it? I mean, Singapore, just take away or eat out diet is absolutely terrible for diabetes. It's basically killing you. But so many people will say, in fact, my doctor's friend will confirm with me that when you ask them to change their diet, they say, but then there will be no pleasure in life. Eating all this tasteless food, what's the point of staying alive? I would rather die. And although they don't mend it seriously, but their behavior is literally killing themselves. You know? So the diabetes never get under control because they absolutely refuse to follow the dietary recommendations. Right? So that's how strong that we unconsciously we are willing to sacrifice our precious life so that we do not have to eat bland, what we consider bland, unpleasant food, even though it's good for us. Right? So that's the so avoidance of unpleasantness, right, is one of the pursuit of happiness that we try. The next one, Buddha said, is of course separation from the pleasant. So this is, we try to be happy, we try to hold on to whoever it is that brings us pleasant sensations, right? For example, eating durian until you lose your voice, but you still keep eating it, isn't it? So the only thing that stops us is because our stomach is of finite volume, we cannot stuff anymore into it. Yeah. So holding on to pleasure, what we regard as pleasant, is another form or another way we seek happiness, another source of happiness for us. Sounds unreasonable, yeah, isn't it? And the last one, of course, is having all our wishes fulfilled. That's really our dream, right? All our dreams, all our wishes will be fulfilled. Isn't it? That's why you know, Buddhist temples rely very much on this idea. People go and pray, you know, offer just the incense and put some donations, keep the temple going, all for praying for our wishes to be fulfilled. Right? So there is also, and when we wish it fulfilled, we always say, you know, this Chinese folklore, that we need to go back and thank the deity, right? Yeah, otherwise something bad will happen to you. Having granted your wish, you must be grateful and go back to give thanks to it. Yeah. So having wishes fulfilled is also another source of happiness. So these are seven things that, right? I think it's a good way of listing out the kind of things that we seek in life. And these are what I would call conditional happiness. I wouldn't say that I would not suggest you don't have any of this. I wouldn't deprive people of the joy of birth for a child, birth, health, youthfulness, life, you know, of not having to experience pain or unpleasantness, not having to separate from whatever that give you pleasure, and to have your wishes fulfilled. It's all nice, isn't it, if you can get all seven of them. Yeah. So, and this, I think, quite fit most people's, at least most people's idea of what happiness would entail. Okay, right. So now I draw your attention to this seven of them. I will call them conditional happiness. They are happiness only depending on conditions, and they can only stay depending on conditions. Right? So for example, let's take a simple one, let's say health. Health is a conditional phenomenon. Our health depends on certain conditions. And if the conditions are here, we are healthy. And our conditions are somehow absent, or we have new conditions that interfere into it, then we experience sickness, right? So we lose our so-called health, and we become sick. And then we have to try very hard, take medications, look after ourselves, have enough rest, take enough water. We try to work with the conditions to bring things back from illness back to health. Right? If we succeed, we get to enjoy life again. If we fail, we will have to face death. Right? So life itself, which is what we long for, we want, is also conditional. Right? Yeah, life is dependent on we having the conditions that to sustain our life, isn't it? And we are lucky these days, you know, life expectancy is getting longer, so that means more and more of us are able to hold on to and sustain those conditions that keep us alive. But then now and then, you know, something happens, we might be deprived of some of those life-sustaining conditions, or we encounter conditions that are destructive, yeah, which sort of destroy this delicate balance of conditions for life, and therefore we end up having to face death. Okay, so life itself is source of happiness, but it's also conditional. Right? So one of the implications of being conditional means it changes. Right? It cannot last. It cannot stay constant, no matter how hard we want it to. Of course, it can stay relatively constant for quite a long time. Right? So the fact that some of us, like my father lived until 90 years old, so he sustained the conditions of life for 90 years, you know, pretty long, I think. Yeah. So it doesn't mean that a conditional thing doesn't mean that it has last only just one moment. But nonetheless, it is subject to change. So after 90 years, it also has to face death. Okay, so that's the thing to look at and to highlight to ourselves is all these different items that we may associate with happiness are conditional. And I say it's both the good news and the bad news. The good news is you can do something, we can do something. We gather the right conditions, then we get to enjoy this type of happiness. But within it, we also must be a bit cautious. We must understand precisely because they are conditional. Therefore, they are also subject to change. And if we have a kind of, this is very typical Buddhist idea. So the reality is here and our expectation is here. So if our expectation coincide with reality, wonderful, no? So then there's no hidden surprise. Right? What you expect is exactly what is real, what is true. And then you get to, whatever you do will be in accord with reality. But the problem happens when there's a discrepancy between the reality and our expectations, our ideas in our head. Right? Depending on how big that discrepancy is, then this is the source of suffering. So for example, we may have the expectation that I will stay young forever. It's not uncommon. People get shocked that they, oh, I'm getting old, as if it's news, yeah, you know. But this idea that I will always be young is a certain expectation, a certain idea inside our head. And then the reality, of course, is that we don't stay young. We age. Every day we get older and older. So that's the reality of our body, of ourselves. And so if there is a huge discrepancy, you'll find that every wrinkle that appears may be a source of great distress for someone that expect themselves to stay young, to look young, to show no sign of aging. Yeah. Right. So the fact that we age may not in itself be suffering, but if we have the wrong expectation, then for sure it will cause us to suffer. So that's another thing to keep in mind is we can actually enjoy conditional happiness so long as we adjust our understanding, our expectation, so that it accords with the reality of these things. Right? So this is one of the main idea I want to emphasize today in this session. Right? Okay, so okay, conditional happiness, you are with me? Yeah. And so we work very hard, we work long hours in Singapore, we do all sorts of things. It's of course to secure what for us important, what we feel is important to us, what we feel will bring happiness to ourselves. So we are actually securing the conditions for our happiness. So what I'm presenting is nothing new. Right? Whether explicitly or implicitly, that's what we are doing. Right? It's just that different people may define happiness differently, and therefore we try to gather different kind of conditions. Right? If you think money is very important for happiness, then money is a major condition that we look for, right, in order for us to be happy. But then there are also other people, people can settle on different things. Yeah. Some people may have decided that they don't want to accumulate money, they want to accumulate experiences. So not so sure about Singapore, but I've encountered people who they work very hard, gather enough money, and then they quit the job and off they go for an adventure. They will have an adventure until they max out their credit card. They have no other choice, then they have to come home and work to pay off the debt and accumulate some money, and off they go for another adventure. The adventure could be going mountain climbing, rock climbing, travel around the world, or whatever it is. So different people have different definition of happiness. And so if you define happiness differently, you instinctively, or we gather the different conditions that we feel will bring us that happiness. Okay? So in and of itself, there is no problem. But why does the Buddha highlight this? The Buddha is very interesting as a teacher. He doesn't always put down on conditional happiness. Actually, he sort of like, you know, depending on who is in front of him. Chinese citizen, saying you meet a human, you say human speech. You meet a ghost, you say ghost speech. 见人说人话，见鬼说鬼话. The Buddha is very flexible, right? Depending on who is in front of him, who is asking him questions, he quite often adjusts what he advised them, right? So I think a lot of those teachings where he probably assess the person or his audience and find that they are not, maybe they are not ready for some of the things that he himself has realized. They're just out there. They're just curious about this person that, you know, they hear rumors that this person is supposed to be enlightened. This is back during Buddha, historical Buddha's time. So they just look like this day, you know, Tibetan Lama come to town, you know, you see the advertisement, and your friends say, hey, let's go and check out the Lama. So then they also, in the ancient India, they also do the same thing, right? They went there. Of course, not nowadays with PA system and all this kind of thing. But then you just go up and introduce yourself, ask a few questions of this holy person that came to town, and so to speak. And then depending on who these people are and where he thinks they may be at, then he will adjust his teaching accordingly. Right. So he, even on the topic of happiness, he has different presentation of happiness. For some people, he will present what he thinks will be helpful for them to achieve conditional happiness. Then there are others who felt that, you know, they can go further, and that will be when he talk about unconditional happiness. Okay, so in terms of conditional happiness, previously we talked about this list that the Buddha has presented. I have introduced briefly. They talk about four types of happiness, three of which are conditional. Happiness of sensual pleasures, happiness of the pleasures that come from our senses. This is very important to acknowledge, you know, that we do derive a lot of pleasant experiences from seeing, hearing, seeing wonderful sights or beautiful places or whatever it is, hearing nice music, smell and taste, usually from food, you know, touch, you know, touch and from massage or whatever other. So these are sensual pleasures. So there are certain happiness associated with sensual pleasures. This is the first time. Second time, the Buddha emphasized happiness or what he called blamelessness, living a life in which you feel that you are free from regret or blame. You have a very clear conscience. That means living an ethical life. And previously I mentioned, you can also think of it as living a very meaningful life. Ethical life can also be doing, means you do things that you feel are deeply meaningful and purposeful, that is in line with your deeper sense of ethics, your principles. And if you do it, then you'll find that it's not always pleasant, but you feel that your life is very meaningful. And it gives you a certain kind of contentment, a certain form of happiness. So that has gone beyond just looking for pleasant feelings. You know, this going to a point where you feel that you are living a very meaningful, a good life, so to speak. Not just pleasant life, but a good life. Okay. So the second type of happiness of blamelessness. The third type of happiness is the Buddha identified. It's what I very sort of addicted to. The happiness of meditative absorption. So my whole spiritual journey is all to do with meditation. Yeah, so later we're going to do meditation. You cannot go away from my class without meditating. You can fall asleep, but no. But I will still try to get you to meditate. The happiness of meditative absorption, which is happiness of the mind. Because in meditation, the mind is able to put aside things that distract us, things that bother the mind. So the mind can enter and dwell in states of absorption that is very pleasant and also very positive, very wholesome. So these three are conditional happiness. Why conditional? because they depend on conditions, and when conditions change, they disappear. It's true for sensual pleasure, of course, not like durian. When you finish eating durian, the last piece of durian slides through beyond the mouth. That's it. There's no more taste. There may be an aftertaste a little bit. Then after you rinse your mouth, that's the end of your sensual pleasures. All you're left with are memories of the durian until you eat again, which you have to wait for the next day. At least you have to digest this durian before you can have it again, right? So it's very transient. When the conditions change, it's finished. That's true also for happiness of blamelessness. This one, very pity, no? You just have to make one mistake, one big mistake, and there goes your blamelessness. So not so easy to accomplish. In fact, the Greek philosopher have this idea that you can never judge whether a person has lived a good life until their day. Because even on the deathbed, you can make some serious ethical mistake that sort of soil or sully your so-called good life. Yeah. So only after you are dead and gone, then you can say, oh, that person has lived a good life. And Chinese have this idea also. In Chinese, you say, gai guan lun ding. It's only when you nail down the coffin, then can you make a final judgment of the quality of this person's life, whether he or she has lived a good life or not. Right? So again, blamelessness is transient. It depends on conditions. The last one, meditative absorption. This one is really, really transient. You know, because I've been teaching meditation for a long time, I also get to hear all those marvelous experiences that people have that I don't have. So I'm always very grateful that they share their wonderful experiences with me. So I don't see light. No, I don't have visitation, no visions come to me. No, don't really have, apart from some buzzing in my fingertips, no, I don't have all this bliss and kundalini awaken and all sorts of things happen, cannot fall asleep at night, too much energy, or they feel this and the sensitive, all sorts of wonderful, varied experiences. I don't have that. So it's nice that they share it with me. But they all share a characteristic. Is they are transient. You know, what they are telling me are from their memories. So that experiences have passed. And sometimes as a meditation teacher, I have to break bad news to good people. Because often the next question they ask me is, how can they get back that wonderful experiences? How can I get back the bliss? How can I get back the light? How can I get back the vision? You know, how can I get back that state of stillness or calmness or oneness? And as a good meditation teacher, I have to tell them they will never come back. That's very important. You have to tell them, we have to tell ourselves, that experience, that wonderful experience that I just have, is never coming back. Why? Because that depends on a certain set of conditions, right? And one of the things that actually prevent them from coming back is precisely this craving to have it back. So once you have this sense of wanting, I want it back, I want it back, this is the interfering element. When you have that wonderful experience, you don't know what to expect, right? So you don't have the craving. So your mind is very open, very receptive, which is one of the conditions that allow you to have this wonderful experiences. But once you have it, there's this thing that, oh, I want more of it, I want. So the wanting or the craving starts, and that interferes with you having all these wonderful experiences. So I have to tell them the bad news. They're not coming back, so that they can let go of the wanting. And once you let go, other different experiences can come to you again, right? So that's the idea behind it. And this shows that even very blissful, very extraordinary, unusual experiences that we can get from meditation are also conditional, are also transient. Right? So this is actually the main problem with conditional happiness, right? That it is subject to change, it is transient, that despite our best effort, quite often we cannot hold on to them. So we have to learn to let them go. If we can accept that, then there's no problem. You can have as much conditional happiness as you want, or as you can have. Right? But if not, then you can really, really suffer. So far, okay? So I'm trying to convince you two things, actually. There's nothing wrong with experiencing conditional happiness. Okay? Because a lot of people come to Buddhism and they hear this term renunciation. Then they feel like Buddhism is asking them to give up all the pleasures in life. I cannot eat durian anymore because I will be attached to it. That's not true, okay? So it doesn't mean that the spiritual path requires you to make all this sacrifice of all pleasures. You can only experience pain. That's not true. So we can have as much conditional happiness as we can get, actually, so long as... But if we don't want to suffer, then we must understand their nature clearly, that they are conditional. Right? So that's one message. But before I go on, let's look at this conditional nature. Let's look especially the conditional nature of meditative experience. Because I think that is actually a good source of happiness. So if you can somehow make it happen in our daily life, this form of conditional happiness, the conditional happiness of meditative absorption, can really benefit us greatly. Right? Not just while we are meditating, but even after the meditation, which is one reason why these days mindfulness is such a hot topic. Yeah, mindfulness is very much a quality that we cultivate when we meditate. And we find, and these days research has found that it has a lot of benefits. You know, it's a conditional state, so we don't expect ourselves to be. In fact, I usually try to tell people, don't try to be mindful every moment. A lot of people say, how can I be mindful every moment? I say, don't do it. Don't do it. You're setting up yourself to fail. You don't have to do it. Some moments we can be mindful, and there are also moments we don't have to be mindful. Like when we fall asleep, we don't have to be mindful, we just sleep. Right? And also, and don't try to be mindful of everything. It's not humanly possible. Right? So you are mindful of one thing, you will probably be mindless of other things. Right? So the aim is not to be mindful of everything, but to be mindful of whatever that is important or relevant. Okay. But having said that, let's look at the conditions behind meditation or good meditation experience. Because I think learning about this and experiencing it in our meditation can really deepen our appreciation of the teaching on conditionality. This whole, I've been talking about conditional happiness, right? When you have a very direct experience of how, when conditions gathered, something happened. Conditions disperse, that experience stop. And you actually witness it in your own experience, and you learn even to play with it. You learn how to adjust conditions. You see them coming together, and then you experience within your own body and mind, the pleasures that come of meditation. That is very beneficial. And then you also experience when the conditions change, you know, like when your alarm goes off and the meditation starts to dissipate and the pleasure also disappears with it. Then you also understand, oh, that's what we are talking about, conditional happiness. When conditions change, then that happy feelings will also disappear with it. And this is not based on theory, but based on your own experience. And the more we internalize that lesson, the more we are able to apply it to other aspects of our life, such as relationship, very important source of happiness for human beings. Relationship is just as conditional, as transient as anything. Right? Even people who, recently my friend, she's in her 80s and she lost her best friend. They knew one another since kindergarten. There's like 70, 80 years of friendship. Wonderful, very close, but inevitably, because it's life is conditional. So we still have to say goodbye. Right? So when we internalize the lessons of conditionality, it really can help us deal with all these changes in our life. Okay? So I think the best, my personal bias, of course, the best place to test out and learn this lesson is quite often in meditation, right? Because meditation allows us to, it's like, for me, it's like the laboratory of the mind. So that's where we carry out the experiment, that's where we observe the result, and that's where we can deepen the lesson in ourselves. Okay? So what are some of the conditions that allow us to go deeper into our meditations? So some of you may have heard this, and I always repeat myself, you know, even on Saturday class. Yeah. I think the first thing, so I just list out the conditions, and later we do a meditation together and test it out. The conditions for a good meditation session, or I shouldn't say that, because all meditation session is good. I've told you all, right? Okay. So the first thing is, of course, the posture. Right? Very important is to find a posture that is comfortable, that doesn't cause unnecessary pain or discomfort, and that really supports us. Okay. Sitting on a chair is wonderful. If you can sit on the floor, that's also good, but not necessary. And lying down is also good. Right? In Singapore, I don't usually say, because I'm in a Buddhist center, and people will freak out if I ask people to lie down in a Buddhist temple. But in the West, when I'm teaching in Sydney or other places, I actually tell people to just lie down, right? Because a lot of people have lower back problems. They have all sorts of issues, and sitting for, even sitting still for 20, 25 minutes aggravates their underlying conditions, a lot of discomfort. Whereas if you ask them to lie down, they can achieve a deeper degree of physical relaxation. That, we'll come to that later. So actually lying down, supine on your back, is not it's a pretty good choice also. Right? So the condition, first condition, posture. Not the idea, not kind of an ideal posture, but one that suits your body, suits your needs at that time. Okay? Second condition that I think really helps us with our meditation is to take care of the body, help the body to release some of the unnecessary reactions, all the tension and tightness and contractions. So of course, when the body releases some of this unnecessary tension, we tend to call it relaxation. In fact, there's a technical term, they call it the relaxation response, which is the opposite of our stress response. Stress response, when we perceive or we think that there's something very threatening in our environment, maybe at work, something very stressful. So we react to that stress. So, you know, adrenaline pumping, heart rate increase, you know, we sort of tense up our fight or flight response. So relaxation response is the opposite of it. It's the undoing of all those stress responses. And in our day and age, with so much stress going on in our life, can be very physically helpful. And also, it's quite pleasant, actually. Yeah. So the second one is to try to trigger a certain degree of release or unnecessary tension. And the method I always emphasize is return our attention to our body. It's so simple that you couldn't believe it. It's just to pay attention to how your body is feeling at this moment. Right? It doesn't matter even the body feels tight or uncomfortable. Just by giving it attention, actually slowly start to change things. Right? So later we'll do that. So this is the second condition. Give our attention back to the body to trigger a release of our bodily reaction. Okay. So Saturday someone asked me how to settle our mental reaction, our mental reactivity, our agitations, right? Thinking about this, thinking about that, worrying, still getting quite upset in mind, even though we are not at work or we are no longer at a place of argument and so on. So those are our mental reactivity, our restlessness, our agitation in the form of thinking, usually in the form of thinking. How do we settle them? Because that would be the next thing we need to work with. Very simple. If you do the second step well, if you manage to help your body to release some of the bodily reactions, what comes up along with it is a sense of pleasure, right? Because you tight, and then relax. It feels nice, right? Maybe very short, but there's a nice feeling, a comfortable feeling, right? And if you pay attention to that pleasure or comfort, right? Pleasure and comfort are only experienced when our life is not in danger, when we are not running away for dear life, right? If we are in endangered, try as you might, you will not have a pleasant feeling. There's no way you can have a pleasant feeling if you feel that the danger is still around. But the moment you start to feel something pleasant, something relaxing, something comfortable, it's a signal. You know, somebody within you, you perceive that you are safe, that things are secure. So just now we pay attention to the body, now we pay attention to the pleasures that come out of your meditation. Then that pleasure calms the mental reactivity. The mind, first the body gets the message, oh, no need to work so hard, okay, I relax. Then neither the mind say, oh yeah, no need to think so much, okay, I also relax. Then the mind will start to drop all this blah, 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 blah. You'll feel that they start to drop away. They won't stop completely, but you may find that the mind is less obsessive. You know, it might yeah a little bit and then change topic. Okay? So you find that the compulsiveness of the thinking starts to get weaker and weaker. It's a sign of the calming of mental reactivity. Right? And what trigger it? What are the conditions that trigger it? Noticing, appreciating pleasant sensations that come out of your meditation. Okay, now the type of pleasure is also important. Okay, it must be the pleasure that come out of the meditation, not the pleasure of, oh, my computer game, I need to go back and play that computer game. Or if we are, but these days they don't have with Netflix, it's all spoiling the market. But in the old days, we always go for the TV drama, you know, the episode, no, the next episode coming, and you want to go home and you want to get it, no. These days, you just binge watch on Netflix. Right? Yeah. So, but pleasures that derive from other things will distract you from your meditation. Right? You will keep saying, when can I stop meditating so that I can turn on my Netflix and continue binge watching? Or I binge watch on YouTube. Right? Yeah. I'm a bit cheapskate. Yeah. Watch free video. Okay. So, but that kind of pleasure distracts the mind. So, the pleasures that we want to focus on and notice are pleasures that come out within the meditation. And if you can appreciate that, you can experience that, you actually bring your attention more, gather your attention into your meditation. Am I making some sense? So these are the three conditions. Posture, help calming your bodily reaction by returning your attention to your own body, and calming your mental reaction by returning your attention to the pleasures that come out of your meditation, right? And then if you do this three step well, you will, the fourth step is you will encounter your own mind. The mind becomes very prominent in your experience. It might sound a bit strange, but when we start meditating, the body or the sound in the environment or the physical thing dominate in our experiences, because our attention is very used to going to all these external things. That's why a lot of beginners meditators find sound very disturbing. Right? We haven't learned to sort of dissociate, in other words, disengage from all these things. So we are very hypersensitive to sound, hypersensitive to, oh yeah, this one, itch. Itch is a, when I first started to meditate, itch is a problem. It seems to be, always seems to be a mosquito around. These days, After you get very used to meditation, you don't notice it that much. It's easier for you to disengage from all the from the sound, from the itch, or from because it's easier for the mind to, attention to gather inwards. Right? So later when you as when we get better in meditation, then the fourth step is we become very aware of what is going on, not in the body but in the mind itself. The mind appears to us in our meditative experience. And that's when we are very aware of all the little changes in the mind, the different thoughts that pop into it, the different emotions and feelings. By the way, that is going too far. So we work on the first three conditions, all right, and see whether we can find within our own experience this an understanding of conditionality. In this case, conditionality of our own meditative experience. And by learning to work with those conditions, see whether we find a way for ourselves to gather the right conditions together and then get to enjoy the positive effects of that, which is whatever pleasant experience that come out of your own meditation experience. And then also get to see when occasionally we also know it's not happening because the conditions do not come together. There are other things that interfere. Or maybe, and then, or we may gather the right conditions and then we witness the how the condition dissipates. You know, it falls apart and then the experience also change. Right? Any question before we meditate? Yeah?
Just curious, in terms of what are some examples of unconditional?
Some examples of unconditional habits. There's not an examples. it's singular in Buddhism. No, I cannot say that there is an example of unconditional happiness or unconditional peace because it's not a thing. You know, it's not like I can give you examples of conditional happiness because they are. I won't call them things, but they are like experiences. Yeah, experiences, phenomena. So we can point to different things. Now the unconditional one is very different from this. You wait a few weeks back. When I come to unconditional happiness, then we will discuss it more. Okay? So let's say with conditional happiness, and at least we try to learn how to gather the right conditions for us to enjoy conditional happiness. Yeah. Okay. So let's do a meditation together. So first step is to, first conditions is, these are conditions that at least we can give attention to and try to create the best conditions for ourselves, is our posture. So try to adopt a posture that is most comfortable and supportive for your body. Try to ensure that at least your back, your spine feels comfortable. You don't have to tense up your back muscles to straighten your spine. That's not necessary. In fact, that might contribute to discomfort. But just find a posture that allows the back to be upright in a natural way, that the base of the lower body provide a very stable base to support your body. If you are sitting on a chair, I suggest having both feet firmly planted on the ground. Those of us sitting on the floor, we sit in a comfortable cross-legged position, whichever works for you. Hands, we try to rest our hands in such a way that our shoulders can relax, so we can rest the hands on the knees, or one on top of the other in the lap, or any other way that works for you. Eyes, I usually suggest people you can close them completely. Of course, at any point of time during the meditation, if you want to, you can always open your eyes. In this session of meditation, quite often, quite a lot of us will experience sleepiness, and you might find yourself drifting off to sleep or falling into sleep. And I think that is quite a normal thing. There's nothing to be upset or frustrated about. But you do happen, sometimes it happens, to wake up from your sleep during the meditation. as in the meditation is not over and you come back to wakefulness, then that is the wonderful opportunity to make use of the condition of sleep. Sleep really helps your body to relax. And you can preserve that physical relaxation when you come back to wakefulness. If you make sure that you do not move at all, don't adjust your posture, don't move even a finger. Just come back to wakefulness from sleep. Leave your body as it is, feeling very relaxed, very comfortable, and continue with the meditation. So if that happens, this is my recommendation. Otherwise, let's allow our body to settle into our chosen posture. Become aware of sensations at the points of contact between your body and your feet, your body and the ground in this posture. Really allow your body to feel that it is resting on something very stable, firm, and solid. That your body is safe and balanced and can surrender its weight to your support, to your seat. And given time, the body can begin the process of loosening up, unwinding, releasing unnecessary tension and tightness so that it can settle down comfortably into this posture. So that's the first condition, finding a suitable posture, or what I say, acquiring a seat for your body. The next condition, we are trying to work with calming our different bodily reactions, so there is tension, tightness that are unnecessary. And for that, we simply return our attention to the body. So I'll guide you through this. So let's start by placing our attention just lightly on the crown of the head. So as you rest your attention at the crown, see if you can notice any sensations here, tingling sensation, warmth or coolness, slight sense of pressure, or maybe nothing at all, which is perfectly fine. And then while your attention is at the crown, see if you can, as you notice yourself breathing out, think that you're giving your body and mind permission with the out-breath to release. So breathe out. You can remind them with the word release. So in other words, breathing in, see if you can stay in touch with your body, in this case your crown. Breathing out, see if you can remind them that they can release. So breathe in, be in touch at the crown. Breathe out to release. And then we move on. We don't just stay in any one spot for too long. Just a light touch at your forehead. Just choose a spot at your forehead. Breathe in, be aware of sensations at your forehead. Are you tensing up the muscles of your forehead? And also see if you can also notice the sensation in the rest of your face. Are you tightening the muscles of your jaw or the muscles around your eyes? And when you breathe out, say the magic word in your mind, release. So breathe in, be aware of sensations of your forehead or your face. Breathe out and release. If you can let in a feeling of softness into your own face, any feeling of ease or relaxation into your own face. And if that happens, see if you can just allow yourself to enjoy the pleasures of relaxation. And then moving on, let our attention flow downwards to our throat. Breathing in, be in touch with sensations at the throat. as well as the neck, breathing out, release. And when I say the word release, you don't have to do anything. It's just a reminder. You don't have to make anything happen. You're just reminding your body and your mind that they can release. Maybe by now you will notice some of your mental reactivity in the form of thinking. You find attention may be drawn away elsewhere. And that, again, is also quite normal. But each time I say something, think of it as an invitation. Invite your attention to come back to your own body and continue from there. So moving on from the throat, place our attention on our right shoulder. Just a light touch, breathe in, be aware of sensations at the right shoulder. And breathe out, we remind ourselves to release. And then once again, we move on. The attention flow down to the right elbow. Breathe in, just a light touch. See if you notice any sensations at your right elbow. Breathe out, once again, release. So I call this touch and release at the right elbow. And then we move on to the right wrist, which is an unusual place to pay attention to. So lightly place your attention at the right wrist as you breathe in, release as you breathe out. So feel free to do it in your own way. You're most welcome to ignore me if what I'm saying is not helpful. Otherwise, just let your attention flow into your right hand. See if you can be in touch and aware of sensations in the right hand as you breathe in, release as you breathe out. Release the weight of your right arm. Just allow the entire arm, shoulder, all the way down to the hand to just rest comfortably on the support. Switching side, we place our attention now on the left shoulder. Breathe in, be in touch, be aware. Breathe out and release at the left shoulder. Moving further down to the left elbow, once again, touch and release at your own pace. Then moving down to your left wrist, breathe in, be touch, breathe out and release at your left wrist. Attention to flow into the left hand. Be aware of sensations in the palm of the hand, the back of the hand, sensations in the fingers, all the way to the fingertips. Breathe in, be in touch. Breathe out and release. Release the weight of your left arm. Just allow it to rest comfortably on the support. And then when you feel ready, return your attention to the center of your chest. Just lightly place your attention here at the chest so that you are aware of sensations here as you breathe in. Maybe you can notice the movements of the chest. Maybe you can notice the beating of your own heart. And as you breathe out, once again, remind body and mind that they can release. You can allow any unpleasant sensations in the body to flow away with the breath. You can allow the different thoughts or images or memories that pop into the mind. Maybe they can also go with the breath. Then we allow attention to descend, to go deeper to the abdomen, just below our navel region. Breathe in, see if you can be in touch with sensations at your abdomen, both at the surface and also deeper inside. And as you breathe out, remind yourself to release. And then we allow attention to go even deeper, going further down to the base of our spine, the tip of the tailbone. Just try to imagine placing your attention here, somewhere in the middle of your pelvis, actually. And as you breathe in, be in touch, breathe out, and release. Imagine releasing the weight of your pelvis, allow it to rest comfortably on the seat, cushion, and surrender that to gravity. And then moving on, see if you can place your attention at your right hip joint. Just make a guess if you cannot be sure. The right hip, deep within the body there. Place your attention, be in touch as you breathe in, release as you breathe out. At your right hip. Then let the attention flow down to your right knee, just a light touch as you breathe in, release as you breathe out, at your right knee. Moving further down to your right ankle, when you feel ready, breathe in, be in touch, out and release. Let attention flow into your right foot. Feel the sensations here, the touch with the floor, with the ground. Breathe in, be aware, breathe out, and release. Imagine releasing the weight of your right leg. Just allow it to rest comfortably on the floor. Then when you feel ready, we switch to the left side, the left hip joint. Just make a guess as to its location. Place your attention there, be aware, and release as you breathe out. moving down to your left knee. Once again, touch and release at your own pace. Then continue further down to your left ankle. Once again, breathe in, be in touch with sensations here. Breathe out to release. And then finally, we arrive at our left foot. Feel the sensations here as we breathe in, release as we breathe out. And we give permission to rest the weight of the left leg on the floor and surrender that to gravity. Rest the body in the posture, allow it to continue the natural process of settling down, loosening up, unwinding, releasing. Rest our attention on the natural breath. Allow the breath to be a support, something that we can come back to and experience the sensations of the breath throughout our body as we breathe in and out. And you lie, each time you breathe out, you can always deepen the sense of release. You can say the words, and as you breathe out, continue the process of releasing any bodily reactions, tension, tightness. Also release any mental reactions or the agitations, restlessness, thinking. You can gently allow them to flow away with the breath. Coming back to your natural breath, not to worry if your attention wander off elsewhere, simply invite it back. Once again, be in touch with your own breath. And while you're doing so, see if you can also allow yourself to notice any pleasant sensations that come out of your meditation. You may experience it as a sense of relaxation in certain parts of the body. You may experience pleasures as a feeling of ease, comfort, softness. And sometimes pleasures can arise in other forms, a sense of buzzing in your fingertips or other parts of the body. Any sensations that come across as pleasant, that come out of your meditation, see if you can give your attention to them. Invite them into your awareness, make them a part of your meditation while they're still here. Pleasures are often transient and fade quickly, but while they are here, enjoy them, make them a part of your meditation, and let that pleasure help you to calm the mind of its reactivity. And then finally, I invite you to check in, to notice how your body is feeling at the end of meditation. In particular, can you highlight anything pleasant or positive or beneficial that come out of the meditation for you? And also check in to see how your mind is doing, the quality of your attention. Just notice without judgment whether maybe the mind is feeling very drowsy, very sleepy, maybe it's still fairly agitated, restless, or maybe you notice a certain degree of stillness or quietness or spaciousness within the mind. So mentally we dedicate may anything positive come out of this meditation, anything helpful. May they somehow stay with us, linger in our body and mind, and continue to benefit us long after the meditation is over. I think it's 25 minutes, could be longer than 25, I'm not so sure. And may nobody complain, right? I just want to reiterate, so what we cover today, the topic of conditional happiness. First is, there's nothing wrong with experiencing conditional happiness. Right? In fact, I wish you can get as much as you can of conditional happiness. And the second thing is, the fact that we call them conditional means it depends on conditions. So if we want to have them, like for example, if we want to have pleasant experiences in meditation, we must make sure we gather the right conditions. And so long as the right conditions are present, then of course the experience will continue. But the main thing to note about conditional happiness is when the conditions change, when they are no longer together, or something new enter into the picture, then also the experience or that happiness will also change. May decrease, may disappear, may increase. No, it doesn't always have to decrease, it can increase. I get more money in my bank account, I get happier. No, so it can also go the other way. But the fact that they are conditional means they are often subject to change. When the underlying conditions change, the so-called happiness that is dependent on them also change. I know I'm sort of repeating myself over and over again, but it's an important idea. And the next session we'll look at when we ignore that reality, that fact, that is when we talk about the source of our suffering. Right? So, any questions? You're conditionally happy? Or at least conditionally, no complaint. Yes. So the question is happiness or blamelessness, right? So I was saying that one way of looking at it is when only after we are dead and gone, then can people judge us as whether we have really a good life or not. And so the question is whether isn't it enough just from our own perspective? We look back on our life and say that yes, it's a good life, it's a blameless life, and you can rejoice in it. And is that not enough? Yes, that is enough. Yeah, it's not dependent on, not 100% dependent on others' opinions, because others may not know everything about us. So it is the feeling of happiness or blamelessness comes from within when we look back and we acknowledge that we have did our best, we live according to our own ethical principles, and there's a joy that comes naturally to the mind, and that is the happiness of blamelessness. Yeah. And by that, I also don't mean that we need to live a perfect life. It's not necessary to be perfect, but it's just that we genuinely and sincerely look back and see that we really have done our very best to follow whatever ethical principles that are important to us. And we don't feel any sense of blame. We don't feel any sense of, in this case, so-called regret, but no. And there is a wonderful sense of uplifting joy that come out of it. When it's like we live a wholesome life. The life is whole. It's not fragmented, you know, whereby we're like constantly at war with ourselves, you know, like we are not happy with this part, not happy with that part, and all this. So instead, everything seems to come together, and so there's this feeling of wholeness, yeah. And this is something internal to us. It doesn't depend on other people's judgment of us. Yeah, that's true. But sometimes I think also good to listen. In Buddhism, the Buddha always emphasized it's good to listen to the counsels of the wise ones. I'm sure you meet people who insist that they have lived a good life, but in your honest opinion, they're not so sure that it's true. And when you try to mention it to them, they have an amazing ability to not hear you at all. So sometimes, that's what the Buddha says, sometimes not only do we rely on our inner weakness, which is ourselves, our own heart, but sometimes we also can rely on outer weakness, which is especially people that we respect and we admire, we see good qualities in them. Maybe they can feedback to us and they can point out some blind spots that we are not so aware of. So that's another aspect of it. Yeah. Okay, so so today my aim is to introduce conditional happiness, and then the second session we'll look at what happened, what went wrong when our so-called conditional happiness becomes suffering for us. And usually that is the case, because for a lot of us, even though we know intellectually that those pleasures, those happiness are conditional, but somewhere deep within us, we don't have not internalized that fact, right? And so because we have within us what the Buddha called craving or grasping, we hold on to things, and so we can't let go, and then that becomes the source of suffering. It is doubly terrible if you are Buddhist, and then you know all the information, the intellectual information, you know, if I let go, I will be free. But you cannot let go. At least your mind cannot let go. Right? The mind keeps going back to dwell on the particular incident, the relationship, or whatever it is, right? And then you suffer. You suffer knowingly. That's double whammy, isn't it? You know the source of your suffering, but you can't get rid of it. At such juncture, sometimes talking to Buddhist friends does not help, because they are a source of aggravation. You know what they're going to say, right? You can see on their face, they're going to give you their wonderful advice. Why, Chong? You just have to let go. They get really pissed with it. Yeah, of course I know, right? I've been telling people that, but I can't let go. Okay, so that is the dilemma. Those of us, those Buddhists, I think everybody, because I think it's not such a secret. Most people can figure that out. Right? If we can drop the thing from our mind, we don't think about it, then it's gone. Yeah, we are free from that suffering. So so we need to look a bit more at this, the troublemaker, right? The craving and grasping, right? Which in a way sullied our conditional happiness. It just changed something that would bring us happiness if we understand it correctly, and change it into a source of suffering for us. So if we can do something about the craving and grasping, then we have the best of both worlds. We may get to enjoy conditional happiness, or we may yet discover unconditional happiness. Isn't it wonderful? Yes, I need to advertise a bit stronger. Because next week there's no class. I don't know why. There's some puja going on here. So not the next Tuesday. So no class. So we continue the week after. All right. Okay. So thank you very much for your attention and have a good week ahead. Enjoy your conditional happiness. Yeah. I'll see you.
Yeah, it's okay, here.
I got to Google it, no?